Hello, I'm Mark Steiner.
I'm Anthony McCarthy.
And the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the University of Maryland Heart Center, where expert cardiologists, cardiac surgeons, nurses, and support staff have built a nationally recognized program focused on prevention, treatment, and rehabilitation. For a virtual tour of the Heart Center, www.umm.edu/heart, or you can go to steinershow.org and click on their banner. And right now, Anthony McCarthy and I are talking with Dr. Mark Kleiman, who is professor of public policy in the UCLA School of Public Affairs, where he was the focus of Michael Corbin's article, Exit Strategy, in this month's Urbanite magazine. This is one of our Urbanite radio conversations. Join us here at 410-319-8888.
Mark,
go ahead, Anthony.
Yeah, I would like to ask Dr. Kleiman. I read with interest Exit Strategy in the Urbanite, and I was fascinated by the fact that we're still trying to analyze, and I'd love to get your take on this, why the so-called war on drugs was not successful. I mean, there seems like there have been, from New York to Baltimore, certainly other urban areas that had to deal with huge drug industry. There were all these different strategies. I mean, here in Baltimore, we had a zero tolerance policy that people seemed to support because on the surface, it really cut down on the public face of violence associated with drugs. It cut down on the public face on our corners of drug dealers. But it did not work. It didn't work. Well, and a lot of people are asking what would work.
So it cut down on violence and it cut down on disorder. Sounds like working to me.
Well, I think
if you mean it didn't eliminate drug abuse.
Yes, that's what I meant.
Well, not surprising. look, no legislature can repeal the law of supply and demand. People want the drugs. Somebody's going to supply them. And higher prices, less availability means less abuse, right? So none of the currently illicit drugs is abused nearly as widely as alcohol is. But you're not going to drive it to zero. What you can do is reduce the violence. I mean, if we could have a cocaine market of its current size in terms of the number of cocaine abusers and not have a lot of violence and disorder around it, I'd say that's a pretty good outcome. Hmm. I mean, not if you're one of the cocaine abusers, obviously, but, you know, it's a tough life. The nature of the drug problem is that you're not going to get success because, you know, people like to use the drugs, and some people like to use too much of them. And all you can do is figure out how to minimize the problems that causes for the people who have the problem, for the people around them, and for the larger society. Now, we've not been doing that very well. We've got 500,000 people behind bars for drug dealing. That's not necessary. We've got still a very violent and disorderly market. That's not necessary. But I mean, if the goal, if people are saying the war on drugs didn't work because we still got a drug problem, it's like saying AIDS treatment didn't work because we still got an AIDS problem. Well, sure we do.
But let me take it one step further. I'm trying to think of the interview that I saw with you in Urbanite magazine and some of the things I remember that I've seen before. The process of not locking up so many people in this country, I mean, how do we get there? I mean, as you've written, drug treatment programs are not always the answer because people will detox and fight their addiction when they are prepared to fight their addiction. And it usually comes later in your addiction as opposed to earlier.
That's true by definition. If you want to say that somebody's an addict only if he has a long spell of it.
No, I didn't say that.
Most people with diagnosable drug abuse problems actually recover pretty quickly and on their own. But, you know, when somebody's ready, well, what makes them ready? His wife says, honey, it's the bottle or me. His boss says, show up for work drunk one more time and you're out of here. He gets arrested. Right? So it's not as if the external pressures don't matter. It's not some magic process.
It's not
when people decide to quit. They decide to quit when the social circumstances make it necessary.
Right, and what I'm suggesting is that my experience is that all the reading, interviewing, and work I've done in the area is that people deal with their addiction when they're close to the bottom, however you define that bottom. And then they begin to want to address it, which is why it usually happens when somebody's...
Dangerous myth.
Pardon?
That's a dangerous myth.
I don't know. I don't necessarily think it's a myth. If you look at most drug programs, they're full of people in their 40s and 50s, not people in their teens and 20s.
Right, because, again, most people who have a drug problem get over it on their own. If we study the treatment population, we're missing most of what's going on. Not everybody has to hit bottom. Or, as they say in the 12-step fellowship, some people have a high bottom. So they don't have to completely wreck their lives before they said, no, this really isn't for me. We know from the Hawaii Hope Program is that you get people who, you know, very long-time methamphetamine users, mostly drug in Hawaii. They're on probation for some felony they committed. You say, look, fella, you're being drug tested randomly. Every time you're dirty, you spend a couple days in jail. 80% of them quit without treatment. 80% of them. No drug treatment program in the world can rack up that score. Turns out that most people who have a drug problem really don't want to have a drug problem. You know, they'd rather not use. But the reward is immediate, and the costs are distant, and they give in to temptation. So if you can move some of the costs closer to the event, you can change their calculation and save their lives. And keep them out of prison is the main thing.
Right. And if your concern is making sure that our prisons are not filled with young black men or people of color in general, then something how does something short of legalization or not allow that to happen?
Because if you use probation enforcement, remember, most of the people who have heavy drug habits, illicit drug habits, are criminally active. They're going to wind up under the jurisdiction of the system. You get them to stop, you can radically cut down the size of the market. Cut down the size of the market, you don't have to have that many dealers in prison. And the other thing is, you could stop putting a lot of dealers in prison. I mean, the drug market intervention programs that David Kennedy has been doing, again, focus on the violence and the disorder, not on the dealing. And the goal is not to lock people up. There's no point locking up a drug dealer. There's just another drug dealer to replace him. All you can do is keep it down to a dull roar. So if we stopped imagining that there's something called the war on drugs, that there's something called victory, and that victory means people aren't using drugs anymore, and stop telling our police departments to try to bring about that impossible state of events, we could have a much smaller problem we have now.
Let's see what our listeners have to say and what this conversation has generated for them as we talk with Mark Kleiman, who is professor of public policy at the UCLA School of Public Affairs. 410-319-8888 is the number here. And Jim, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hi, Jim.
Hi. I was calling to ask about the economic impact of legalization of cannabis particularly. Essentially, what would happen to the if they legalized marijuana, would the drug violence from Mexico flow over into the United States, you know, in turf disputes and stuff like that? And if not, how would that help the Mexican economy essentially improve itself so that they can fight their own drug problems and drug wars more efficiently?
Dr. Kleiman?
Okay, so several pieces. The reason the cannabis trade leads to violence is because it's illegal.
Right.
When alcohol was illegal, alcohol dealers competed with Tommy guns rather than with advertising campaigns. So there's nothing about cannabis that's associated with violence other than the fact that it's illegal. So legalizing cannabis would reduce violence, if anything. Unfortunately, the Mexican problem isn't mostly around cannabis. The major big money that's made in Mexico selling drugs to the U.S. is cocaine. But we could somewhat cut down on the Mexican problem by removing one drug from that equation. I think Mexico, again, needs to have a more realistic view, and we need to have a more realistic view about what Mexico can do. They've been under enormous pressure from the U.S. for the last 40 years to stop the flow of drugs from Mexico to the U.S. as if that was something that Mexico could do. Americans want to buy it, somebody's going to smuggle it in. So I think what Mexico needs to do, and I think what they're starting to do, is realize that shrinking the flow of drugs is neither possible nor especially desirable. Reducing the violence is desirable. And that means they've got to focus their enforcement on violence and make it clear to dealers that if they're shooting people up, they're going to get a lot of enforcement attention. And if they're peacefully moving drugs, the cops have other things to worry about.
But how realistic is that? I mean, that scenario, it seems to me it's our addiction and our guns as well that are fueling that war. Mark?
Yes.
Right?
And I'm saying they can have a smaller war. They can't have no drug problem, but they can have a smaller war if they focus their enforcement on violence, not on volume. They target for enforcement the most violent groups, not the ones that are doing the most drugs. They can create a disincentive for violence instead of the incentive for violence that current enforcement techniques create.
410319, I'm sorry. Well. I'm sorry, Mark. Say that again. I walked over your words. What'd you say?
Current enforcement strategies create an incentive for violence. If you're the most violent organization in town, nobody wants to inform on you. If instead we made it the case that the organization that uses the most violence gets the most enforcement attention, then we create a disincentive for violence. And that's what we got to focus on. We should stop imagining the drug laws cut down on drug abuse. And we need some enforcement for those laws. But beyond some fairly minimal level, drug law enforcement does not reduce drug abuse. It can reduce violence. So we got to do that.
410-319-8888 with Dr. Mark Kleiman. And Eugene, you're on the air.
Hey, what's going on? How's everybody?
Well, welcome.
I don't know. It just seems like, you know, it appeared that the war against drugs as it pertained to this city pretty much only dealt with the symptom. When how come they didn't just treat the whole war against drugs at the border level, you know, where the source comes from? It just seems like with the little nickel and dime things that are happening in the street and the violence and stuff like that, it's really directly related to them not drying up what's happening at the border. How come they don't treat the whole drug issue like Homeland Security? I mean, if they are actively pursuing terrorists, how come they don't just treat the whole drug deal as a homeland security issue? Hmm. I'm sorry, that's all I had to say.
All right, thank you, Mark. You want to comment?
Every month, a million containers, right? A container is a freight car or a truck body or the guts of a freight airplane. A million containers come across the border between the U.S. and Mexico. One of those would hold the heroin supply of the United States for a year. Can you say needle in a haystack? We cannot stop drugs at the border. That's fantasy. Jack Lawne, who ran DEA in the 80s, was once asked by a congressman why they weren't stopping drugs at the border, and he said, "Congressman, if we built a 50-foot wall around the United States, the drug dealers would buy 51-foot ladders."
That's the truth.
This is a market problem. It's not a physical flow problem. The problem is that there are Americans who want to use the drugs, and there are other Americans who want to sell them the drugs. And Mexico can't fix that, and we can't fix that at the border.
Well, is there a way, Dr. Kleiman, that we could, and I know I asked this in a roundabout way before, and you kind of dismissed it. Is there a way that we can get to cutting that demand? How do we begin to effectively treat addicts? I mean, I found the example you gave us in Hawaii fascinating, but is there a way that we really could begin to cut America's desire for?
I'm sorry. That is the way. I mean, can you make people not want the drugs? Not through any mechanism I know, and I'm actually sort of glad that our government doesn't have the power to change what's in people's minds.
Yeah.
Can we keep people from using the drugs if they're behaving in a way that gets them convicted of something? Yes. And since that's a very large fraction of the drug market, we can radically shrink the market just by making sure the offenders who are under supervision aren't using, and we know how to do that.
No,
that to me is a drug treatment program.
It would be interesting. I'd like to have some more time to kind of really read more about the Hawaii program. I'm trying to read it quickly on the web, but I don't want to do it quickly because I would do the issue not it wouldn't be fair to do the issue that way. But
can I plug my book?
Of course.
Yeah, you can plug your book.
When Brute Force Fails, How to Have Less Crime and Less Punishment. Princeton 2 years ago, and there's a whole chapter on hope.
And I just pulled out like 7 articles on hope that I intend to read and hope to have you back on the air when we have our next drug conversation. Let me get into the caller in here for you at 410-319-8888. And William, you're on the air.
Y'all stole my son. So everything the gentleman has been saying is absolutely true, because for the past 40 years, I was a substance abuse. And when I stopped, I was incarcerated. On the treatment programs and all that, it didn't do me no good. But so far, all the things he has been saying is absolutely 100% correct. And thank you, and y'all have a wonderful show. I tell you, this is wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you, William. I appreciate you being part of the show. I think that I mean, you're raising some interesting issues, and I must admit, Mark, that as I said, I haven't read this Hawaiian thing nor your book yet, but I intend to do both, and to bring you back on the air here if you'll join us.
I would love to.
And we were hoping to have you on here with Woody Curry, but we couldn't get that arranged this week. We'll do it though another week. Let's try to get another call here before we move on to our next topic, which is Libya. 410-319-8888. David, you're on the air.
Yeah, Mark?
Hi, David, you're on the air.
Yeah, how you doing?
Well.
I want to make a statement, but first of all, I'd like to say, do you have a problem with people that commit crimes being arrested?
Do I?
Yes.
Do I have a problem with people committing crimes being arrested? No, not especially if there are crimes that affect somebody's safety.
No, because I've listened to your show a couple times, and you seem to have an opinion that the police are just riding around locking people up for nothing. A lot of these, I've done studies in the prisons. A lot of these guys in prisons have committed crimes and should be in there. I live in the heart of Baltimore City, right in the Reisterstown Park Heights area.
Yeah.
I see guys get locked up for selling drugs. 2 days later, they're back out on the street doing the same thing. I see guys committing crimes in order to buy the drugs, to get money to buy the drugs. They get locked up. A couple days later, they're back out on the street. But I listen to your show, and I get the impression that you feel that there are a bunch of people being locked up that shouldn't be there. There are a lot of people that get locked up that get right back out. So I don't understand. You've had several shows on there where you almost tell people to not to convict these guys that get locked up for drug problems.
Well, no, what I've said, this is actually more from Mark Kleiman than me today, so what I've said in the past and what I'll say again is that we in America, we lock up too many people. There are too many people in jail for drugs, for nonviolent crimes who do not need to be in prison, wasting our money putting people in prison. We have to address the drug problem in a different way. If someone commits a violent crime, if someone breaks into your home, if someone assaults other people, rapes are committed, murders, crimes of violence, those folks need to go away. There's no question in my mind. People need to go to jail for those crimes. And my time working in the state prison system and working with people who are drug abusers lets me know there are a lot of folks need to be out in this community. We need to deal it in a different way. But there are a lot of people need to be locked up and just left there or until they can find a way to rejoin society. Mark, go ahead.
It's my belief that most of the people who are locked up would behave on the outside if we watched them properly and if we had clear rules and immediate sanctions for breaking the rules. I don't think those folks are completely out of control. We're just not doing the job right. So if we can make community corrections a real alternative to incarceration, which to me means drug testing and position monitoring using GPS and quick sanctions for every violation, I think half or three-quarters of the people who are now in prison, even some of the ones who committed violent crimes, would be safe to have out.
Mark Kleiman, it's been a pleasure to have you with us, and I look forward to having you on very soon again.